Hi, this is Gordon Deal. The Wall Street Journal This Weekend starts right after this.
By 2025, it's estimated that half the world's population will lack access to safe drinking water. A sorry state of affairs as two-thirds of our planet is covered by water. We are helping develop solutions for salt water to satisfy the thirst of future generations. BASF, the chemical company.
Squarespace, the easiest way to create an exceptional website. Squarespace provides everything you need to create a beautiful website for you or your business, including trendy designs and unique styles. And you don't have to worry about getting stuck along the way. Squarespace has a 24/7 support team. Try Squarespace today for free, and when you're ready to go live, enter WSJ at checkout and save 10%. Plus, you get free hosting. Use promo code WSJ at squarespace.com/WSJ. Squarespace.com/WSJ.
Direct from the newsroom of the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal This Weekend with Gordon Deal.
Trouble for housing. I'm Gordon Deal with Gina Cervetti. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
After 2013 showed the promise of a robust recovery, the real estate market has hit the brakes this year. We'll explain why.
A new study finds medications cut violence among the mentally ill, but that has raised new questions.
The Catholic Church has a new problem to address. Hispanics in the U.S. are leaving at an alarming pace. You'll hear the reasons.
And the live music business is predicting a record-breaking summer. We'll identify the bands delivering the goods.
You know, a lot of these big festivals generate so much money in ticket sales and sponsorship also that they can afford to really pay a premium to get some of the best artists there. What a lot of the artists do is use these as kind of anchors for their wider tours. If they know they've got, you know, dates at Summerfest and Lollapalooza, they can route their tours around these and do standalone concerts around them.
Wall Street Journal reporter John Jurgensen on why live music is booming. He's here later in the hour. With persistent concern about the connection between violence and mental illness, a new study provides some of the best evidence to suggest mentally ill people are very rarely violent, but they are more likely to be violent when off their antipsychotic medication. Here's Wall Street Journal reporter Shirley Wong from London. Shirley, what are the findings?
Yeah, so there's been a long history of people worried about a connection between violence and mental illness and a lot of debate about it. This latest study looks at whether there actually is a link, but more importantly, whether people who have a mental illness and are taking antipsychotic medications show any kind of change in violent behavior tendencies when on the medication. And what they find is that in this population they're studying, that individuals, when they're taking antipsychotic medications, show a significant decrease in the amount of violent crimes for which they're found guilty of while they're on the medication compared to when they're not on the medication.
So is this generally saying then that people who are determined to have mental problems should be on medication?
That's one of the big questions, is whether this means that people should be taking antipsychotic medications or not. What it does say is that this is potentially a benefit of taking antipsychotics, that that it may reduce violent or aggressive tendencies. And researchers say that this has to be put in context with, you know, all the other risks and benefits of these types of medications. There has been a lot of talk about whether the drugs are overused and where some of the potentially serious side effects are, in particular weight gain that might lead to things like diabetes. Mm-hmm. But this study suggests that there seems to be a benefit in terms of reducing violent behaviors that might lead to crimes and, you know, the individuals actually getting arrested for, convicted of these crimes.
From a crime perspective, do we know the percentage of crimes committed by people who are considered mentally ill?
So this study was looking at one population in Sweden, but it's a very large study. There are about 80,000 men and women that they looked at and had their criminal records as well. And what they found in this population is that about 6% of the men studied over a three-year period from 2006 to 2009 had been convicted of a violent crime, and somewhere around 1% of the women had. What this means is sort of two things. One is that there is a reduction when they're on the medication, and also the absolute rate of committing a violent crime is still very low. So that 6% of men, that may be higher than in the general population, but overall we're talking about a very small proportion of people who are actually committing violent crimes, whether or not they have a mental illness or not.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Shirley Wong in London about new information on the link between violence and mental illness. How certain is that link, by the way?
Well, there has been a lot of debate in the field, and a lot of mental health experts say that the connection between violence and mental illness is overblown, particularly by the media. You know, obviously there have been a lot of unfortunate incidents involving mass violence, and often the first question that people ask is, you know, does this individual have a mental illness or not? But if you look at the literature and particular reviews that have looked at all the published studies out there, there is an increase for people with a severe mental illness in terms of, again, relatively speaking, relative to the general population, there is an increase in violence. This tends to be the strongest amongst people who are not being treated or who have also drug use or alcohol use, I think drug use in particular. But, mental health experts are very, very quick to say that there is, it's very important to remember that even though there might be a relative increase, again, the absolute rate of people committing violent acts is still very low, whether or not someone has a mental illness or not.
Thanks, Shirley. Wall Street Journal reporter Shirley Wong from the Bureau in London. 12 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. What's going on in the housing market? For most of last year, it looked as if a robust recovery was underway, but housing has the blahs in 2014. Here's Yahoo Finance columnist Rick Newman. Rick, what's up here?
Things are not looking as rosy as they were last year. The latest data show that new home sales have fallen year over year. Existing home sales have fallen year over year. Applications for new mortgages, that's for buying a home, are at a 14-year low. There just don't seem to be many buyers right now. And the real question is this just a slowdown, and we're going to see the resumption of the so-called housing recovery, or was the recovery itself, which lasted for about a year, was that kind of a fake? And are we really still in a housing bust? That's the basic question.
All right. Any explanations here as to why this suddenly has got the brakes put on it?
Well, we know a couple of things that are pretty obvious. First of all, a lot of the buying last year was by investors, not by families buying homes for the traditional reasons, but by investors that decided it was a terrific time to scoop up a lot of those fire sale properties. Many were in foreclosure or close to foreclosure. Interest rates bottomed out during the first half of last year, and the smart money, you know, pools of investor money said, you know, this is too good an opportunity to pass up. So they bought a lot of homes, counted for at least 25% of sales last year, maybe a little bit more. And investors are now kind of backing out of this the market. Interest rates have gone up. There aren't as many distressed properties, so there just are not very many sales to investors, or not at least not as many as there used to be.
We're speaking with Yahoo Finance columnist Rick Newman about why the housing market is suddenly not as rosy as it was last year. You mentioned this 20% down payment. I'm thinking recent college grads with all this debt might, or in many cases, settling for a low-paying job. Good luck coming up with that 20%.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons for skepticism. That's right. They're having a much harder time paying off loans, those who have them. Obviously, we've heard so many stories about them living in their parents' houses, hard to get out. There's one other factor here that's a problem, which is that rents are going up by quite a lot. I mean, that's because we've shifted from an owner-dominated housing market to a renter-dominated housing market. So with more demand for rental properties, rents are going up. And if you're paying more for rent, that just makes it even harder to save for a 20% down payment. So that's the sort of bear case, Gordon. I think it's worth pointing out that not everybody is this gloomy. I mean, there are a number of economists who say, yeah, we know about all those factors, but we do believe there are other reasons to believe that hiring is picking up, wages will pick up eventually, and we will see a lot of those traditional buyers coming back into the market. They're just not ready quite yet. So it's a toss-up right now.
All right, so what about, you mentioned interest rates, mortgage interest rates probably are not going down at this point, right?
they're almost certainly not going down. It seems they almost can't go down. I mean, they've been at or near record lows for about 5 years, and the Federal Reserve is finally backing away from the super easy money policies that have pushed interest rates down. So the Fed has been backing out of its so-called quantitative easing program all year long in 2014 so far. It will probably continue to do that until that program ends. And some economists are surprised mortgage rates haven't gone up more than they have, but they also point out that when interest rates rise, sometimes they can rise very quickly. So the market could turn around in a hurry. Now, on the other hand, Fed Chair Janet Yellen has said she is concerned about housing. She just raised this recently in congressional testimony, and she has said all along that if something happens in the economy that is more worrisome than anticipated, the Fed can change its policy. So if this really got out of control, and it was pretty clear we were in another housing bust or a prolonged one, the Fed could change its policies, and that might push rates down and change things a little bit.
Thanks, Rick. Yahoo Finance columnist Rick Newman from New York. 19 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal This Weekend. It's time now for Gina Cervetti.
This coming week brings an update on pricing trends at the wholesale and consumer levels, and also a new look at retail sales. Economist Bob Bruska says he's anxious to see those sales numbers.
Well, retail sales have been weak, and in the last report, we had a considerable jump. And the question is, how much of a follow-through we get from that jump? I think that makes this an important report.
Bruska expects prices to confirm that inflation is not a concern, and he says we may hear about a small increase in the number of groundbreakings of new homes. Well, you may have noticed the gradual uptick in gas prices. The Lundberg survey finds that the average price of regular has just notched its 12th straight week of price jumps, up now at last report to $3.72 a gallon. But prices are expected to decline as crude and wholesale gasoline costs fall, due in part to ample U.S. crude oil stockpiles and more gasoline production. Should police have access to your prescription drug records? It's becoming harder for law enforcement to access those documents as lawmakers and judges become more receptive to the idea that reasonable or probable cause is needed.
And about two-thirds of them, police can get them as long as they're sort of pursuant to an ongoing investigation. So you have a smaller cohort, about less than a third, where you have to have a warrant or some sort of equivalent showing of probable cause.
The Wall Street Journal's Joe Palazzolo. A trade publication says that last year, Apple replaced the office supply chain staples in the number two spot for overall online sales. Amazon is still the clear front runner. If you own a small business, then Facebook wants your attention and your money. The site plans to hold workshops to show small business owners the benefits of advertising with Facebook. Workshops are planned for New York, Miami, Chicago, Austin, Texas, and Menlo Park, California this summer. Social media companies have been finding it hard to crack the small business market. How do you feel about your job benefits? A Towers Watson survey shows more employee satisfaction with retirement plans than 5 years ago, but less enthusiasm over health care plans.
I think a big part of that has to do with the fact that employers have made quite a few changes in the health care landscape, a lot more of these high-deductible health plans, more of a do-it-yourself approach.
Kevin Wagner is with Towers Watson. Apple is in talks to buy Beats Electronics for just over $3 billion. Also, more Apple news this weekend, with Taiwanese media saying that the iPhone 6 will be out in August, a month earlier than many had expected. There will be one version with a screen under 5 inches, and then in September, watch for an iPhone 6 with an even bigger screen, according to these reports.
All right. Thank you, Gina. Speaking of that Apple story buying Beats, I saw something that said that could make Dr. Dre the first billionaire rapper.
Oh, okay. Really?
Yeah, that'll cover some costs, right? Yeah.
You think he won't have any trouble with the mortgage payment or...
Things are looking good for Dr. Dre. Wow. Thank you, Gina. 23 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal This Weekend. The New York Public Library, a landmark building on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, is dropping its massive renovation plan. More from Wall Street Journal reporter Jennifer Maloney. Jennifer, talk about a 180.
It's a really dramatic reversal. The library for years has been pushing a plan to gut century-old book stacks from its landmark Fifth Avenue building in Manhattan. And for the past couple of years, it has come under really intense criticism for this plan. And we've just learned that the library has abandoned the plan, finally. It will no longer touch the book stacks in its landmark building. Instead, it will renovate a branch across the street. The original plan was to dismantle these century-old book stacks and in their place create a new circulating library to replace a dilapidated branch across the street that was in dire need of repair. But a whole coalition of Pulitzer Prize-winning authors, community groups, politicians, preservationists had fought the plan. Three lawsuits had been filed, and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio had been skeptical of the plan. His supporters had been pushing him to claw back $150 million in city funding if the library didn't change its plan.
I know moving the stacks became really a big issue. Can you explain the relevance of that?
Sure. So the New York Library's flagship building on Fifth Avenue has historic book stacks that they not only hold or they held the research collection that served the famous Rose Main Reading Room above, but they also provided the structural support for that reading room. The library said that they were going to move all the books out of those book stacks. So there was a hue and cry over this idea of shifting millions of research volumes out of the library. There was also criticism about sort of the destruction of a piece of this building, seven levels of metal book stacks that were not open to the public, but the preservationists argued that they had significant historic and architectural significance, that they were sort of a key component of this landmark building. And the library intended to basically gut them and build a brand new circulating branch library in their place.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Jennifer Maloney in New York about the New York Public Library scrapping plans for its redesign. With regards to any renovations now, what's going to be most noticeable, say, besides these empty shelves at the main branch?
The books now will be held under Bryant Park. So they have to sort of build a new sort of conveyor retrieval system to bring those books to you.
Did you say a conveyor retrieval system?
So the original 1911 design, the stacks are underneath the reading room. So there was a pneumatic tube system where your sort of book request slip would shoot down a pneumatic tube. And there was sort of a whole sort of scurrying set of staff underground in these levels of book stacks that would go and retrieve your book and then send it up an elevator. Well, with the books stored under Bryant Park, they have to build a new conveyor system to bring those books into the reading room.
A conveyor retrieval system. Sounds so old school, doesn't it? People scurrying around, fetching the book from under Bryant Park, then sending it up to the library. Wonder if it can double as a people mover, say on a rainy day. 30 minutes after the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend.
Hi, I'm Lex Friedman. I run my own business called Podlexing. So I know from experience, hiring new employees can be tough. With so many job boards out there, how can you know which one will produce the best talent? Realistically, to fill the position fast and with the perfect candidate, you need to post your job on all the top job sites. And now you can do it with a single click with ZipRecruiter.com. ZipRecruiter.com lets you post to more than 40 job sites at once. ZipRecruiter.com also posts your job on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. Just post once and watch the qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. You can screen applicants, rate them, and hire the right people fast. Try ZipRecruiter free right now and find out why it's been used by over 100,000 businesses. And right now, listeners of this program can try ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ. That's ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ. One more time, to try ZipRecruiter for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ.
Powered by the most trusted name in journalism, you're listening to The Wall Street Journal this weekend.
Where are all the Hispanics going? That's what the Catholic Church wants to know. A new study by Pew finds Hispanics in the U.S. have been leaving in droves over the past 4 years. Here's Wall Street Journal reporter Miriam Jordan. Miriam, explain the trend.
This shift actually mirrors what's been occurring both in Latin America in terms of Catholics flocking to evangelical Christian denominations such as Pentecostalism in recent years at the expense of Catholicism. It also mirrors more broadly shifts that are taking place in the U.S. where Catholicism has been losing followers, and the share of the people who identify as religiously unaffiliated has been growing considerably. you know, many of the evangelical churches have a lot of music, which is an attraction. Some of the congregants who I met talked about the more participatory nature of evangelical Christianity as they see it. They think it's a less kind of hierarchical, you know, religious system, if we can put it that way. I mean, obviously, this doesn't reflect failure on the part of the Catholic Church. It really just reflects changes in society as a whole.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Miriam Jordan about the growing number of Hispanics in the U.S. leaving the Catholic Church. Is there anything that the Catholic Church might be able to do to reverse this trend?
Yes, the Church is reaching out to Hispanics. It's trying to form more Hispanic priests. It's involving more Hispanics in lay activities, in lay study formations. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops told me that, you know, reaching out to Hispanics is crucial and that it's working strategically to increase the number of Hispanic seminarians and priests as well as the number of Hispanic children in Catholic schools, because actually among Hispanic youth, 71% who were raised Catholic stay Catholic, according to a study. And that's actually a higher figure percentage than for the population overall in the U.S. of non-Hispanic whites, for instance, it's 62% only. So the Church says that there's been a huge increase thanks to these outreach efforts in the number of Hispanic deacons who work in parishes. It's also advanced Hispanic leadership in lay service, with 43% of those in leadership formation programs currently Hispanics. So, you know, the Church is trying to counter this trend. You know, this population is very much the future of the Church in the United States. It's currently the second largest population group in the United States, and it's very quickly growing.
Thanks, Miriam. Wall Street Journal reporter Miriam Jordan. 22 minutes now before the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. NFL teams now have shiny new first-round picks to show off, and many fans will be quick to run out and buy the jerseys of the new favorite players. But what happens when one of these players becomes a bust? Yeah, your jersey is quickly outdated. The Wall Street Journal this weekend's Mike Gavin tells us about how one team is trying to help.
Well, Gordon, we found out this week the New England Patriots are offering to help soften the blow by offering a jersey guarantee. The team will offer a rebate to anyone who buys a jersey of a player who is no longer under contract to the team within a year of the purchase. Now, this isn't a full refund, but it is a 25% discount toward the price of the next Patriots jersey that you buy. You might remember that the Patriots took the unprecedented move last year of allowing anyone who had bought a jersey of Aaron Hernandez, who is charged with murder, to exchange it for the jersey of another player. More than 1,200 fans took the team up on the offer. So with this in mind, Pats fans can go out and buy the jersey of the new defensive end, Dominique Easley, with 25% more peace of mind.
That's clever. Well, good for them. I mean, those jerseys are expensive. You're buying an authentic one, you're locked in for at least $100.
At least. I could have used this 12 or 13 years ago.
Here we go. Who'd you buy?
There is, I think, still somewhere in my house.
Yeah.
A Ron Dane Giants jersey.
From the Giants,
around, I think, 2000 or so that happened. And I don't go out, I don't buy jerseys with players named very often. But I went, you know, I loved what was going on then. They had him with Tiki Barber. They were doing this thunder and lightning thing, if you remember.
Right. That's right.
And it looked like things were going really, really well until they didn't very, very quickly.
Wow. He was a Jersey kid, Ron Dane.
Yeah,
he
I think so.
Played at Wisconsin. Thing, right?
Yeah. Heisman Trophy winner. And I think somewhere in my house, I think that jersey still resides, because I refused to get rid of it because I paid so much money for it at the time. So this would have been helpful for me back then.
You need a hashtag TBT.
You know what?
Put that picture on Twitter or Instagram.
Not a bad idea.
Very good. All right, thanks, Mike. 18 minutes now in front of the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. With many moms and dads serving as the sole financial providers in their households, Career Builder's latest research takes a closer look at how genders compare in terms of income, career advancement, and job satisfaction. Spokeswoman Jennifer Grass says while salary data indicates that female breadwinners may have a tougher time making ends meet, working moms in general tend to be happier in their jobs. Jennifer, explain what we're learning.
Well, I think what we found was that while the gender gap is improving, there's still a significant disparity between what men and women earn, the types of roles they gravitate to, and the levels they reach within organizations. Working moms who are the sole breadwinners in their homes generally don't earn as much as working dads. So when you look at compensation trends, working dads who are the sole financial providers in their households were four times as likely to earn six figures, while working moms who are the sole breadwinners were nearly twice as likely to earn less than $35,000. So there is a big difference there. You know, when you look at things from a title perspective, the good news is working moms and dads who are sole financial providers were equally likely to work in a management position, so about 20% for both genders. So that's a positive trend, but more men reported holding a senior management role, such as a CEO, CFO, senior VP, so there were less women in the corporate office, so to speak.
So break down some of the findings for high and lower income households.
So when you look at the working moms and dads that are earning less than $35,000 annually, working moms, it was 38%. Working dads, it was 21%. And then when you look at a higher earning bracket, so those that are earning six figures, working moms, it was about 6%. And for working dads, it was 24%. So I think that we continue to see some challenges there. I think companies have taken steps to improve that. But we obviously have a lot of work to do to have those compensation trends catch up for women.
We're speaking with Jennifer Grass at Career Builder. What about when it comes to job satisfaction?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because while women, you know, tended to earn less than men, the working moms are less than working dads, they tended to be more content in their jobs overall. So 78% of working moms reported that they're happy in their current roles, compared to 73% of working dads. So there's a different perspective there. It's not necessarily all about the money. It's looking at the overall work experience, the time that they're able to spend at home with their kids, too.
And speaking of stay-at-home parents, what did employers say about their skills?
Well, you know, being a mom or dad is a full-time job in itself. I'm a mom. I certainly know that firsthand. But the majority of employers believe that parenting can actually qualify as relevant experience for the workplace. 65% of employers told us this. And so some of the skill sets that they say that you pick up as a parent are the ability to multitask, conflict management, good problem-solving skills, mentoring, budgeting and managing finances, negotiation skills, project management skills. There's a lot of skills that you develop as a parent, you know, to teach, troubleshoot, manage multiple priorities, arbitrate, that are very transferable to corporate environments. So if you're a parent that's getting back into the workforce or maybe you're first joining it, you want to incorporate what you learned from those experiences at home.
Thanks, Jennifer. That is Jennifer Grass from Career Builder. 11 minutes now before the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Once again, here's Gina Cervetti.
And happy Mother's Day weekend. This coming week brings an update on how Americans are feeling about the economy. That's an important indicator because it can give us an idea of whether people feel like spending or not.
Consumer sentiment, I think, has had some rebounds in the last month or so. I don't really think it's going to have much in the way of legs, so I'm looking for that report to continue to hover.
Economist Bob Bruss. Does your income play a role in the cost of your car insurance? Laura Adams with Insurance Quote says that while almost half of Americans believe that to be the case, it really is not.
Driving record is a really big part in what you have to pay. So do you have a clean record or are there lots of accidents and traffic tickets on your record? Also, your age, your gender, and in many cases, marital status.
But your credit history does factor into your insurance rates. College, in general, a new Gallup survey finding that it's not which school you attend that predicts how you'll do in life overall, but matters more what you do while in school. The Journal's Doug Belkin tells us more.
Whether or not you have professors or mentors who take a real interest in you, and the second is that you have long-term academic projects and you take the knowledge you learn and apply it somehow.
So maybe you don't need to shell out for that pricey Ivy League degree after all. McDonald's reportedly plans to test new French fry offerings with various seasonings, including garlic parmesan. Meanwhile, rival Burger King is launching burgers at breakfast, bringing its signature Whopper and other burgers to its breakfast menu. What are you on vacation saying, I just have to have this brand nearby when I'm away from home?
Travelers' favorite brands include Southwest Airlines, Enterprise for car rentals, and Snickers as an energy stack. A snack, I should say. Maybe you want a stack of those snacks. Those are among the results of TripAdvisor's Travelers' Choice Awards. Starbucks was the coffee that Travelers listed as a must-have, and Samsonite was the go-to carry-on luggage.
Good. All right. Thank you, Gina. It is 8 minutes now before the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. It's not too soon to be mapping out your summer concert plans. Wall Street Journal reporter John Jurgensen has a look at the state of the live music business and some of the new approaches emerging this summer. John, what are we seeing?
Things are looking pretty strong for this summer. There's a lot of big tours out. The festival business is doing quite well. There's a big range of festivals out there, and that's an interesting way to look at it. You don't have just, you know, you have your big ones like the Bonnaroos and the Coachellas and Lollapaloozas, et cetera. There's a lot of mid-tier festivals, too, the ones that might be, you know, about 20,000, 25,000 people or so compared to, you know, the masses of the 80,000.
Yeah.
Capacity big festivals. So there's a lot of range out there. So everything from, you know, big stadium tours from Jay-Z and Beyonce to smaller kind of boutique festivals that you're seeing in different regions.
So are festivals all the rage? Because I feel like I've heard more about them now than when I was growing up.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of thing where the festival business in the United States has been growing really steadily for the last decade or so. You know, the early ones that got in there and did it right, like Coachella, like Lollapalooza, the ones I was mentioning there, those have become real institutions now. You know, so, for example, Lollapalooza sold out this year in about 20 minutes, and that was before the lineup was even announced.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter John Jurgensen about the state of live music as we head into the summer concert series. Are there advantages for bands to play these, other than the revenue, obviously?
Yeah, you know, big advantages. I mean, well, the revenue is one of the biggest ones because you can generally earn more on a festival date. I mean, especially if you're a headliner than you might on a standalone concert.
Oh, yeah? How come?
Well, essentially what they're doing is getting you to come for a one-off event. You know, you're not shouldering any of the production costs. I mean, the festival's paying for that. So they're essentially bringing you in to play this one-off date. And, you know, a lot of these big festivals generate so much money in ticket sales and sponsorship also that they can afford to really pay a premium to get some of the best artists there.
Wow.
So what a lot of the artists do is use these as kind of anchors for their wider tours. If they know they've got, you know, dates at Summerfest and Lollapalooza, they can route their tours around these and do standalone concerts around them.
Any bands that tend to play the festivals or be the real popular bands at these festivals?
Well, this year the trophy for the most festivals goes to Outkast.
Okay.
The rap duo from Atlanta, which have you know, they've essentially reunited for this summer's festival circuit after about 10 years absent from the scene. And they are playing more than a dozen. I think the number might be 14 or 15 major festivals this year. And they're not doing any standalone dates. So that goes back to the idea that, you know, they can make a lot of money and not pay a lot of expenses to do this kind of tour. Of course, that also allows them to get in front of a lot of people, you know, at one time. Other kind of younger acts that are really popular on the festival circuit. I mean, there's a lot of them. I mean, Lord. The young New Zealand singer is huge this year and came up very fast. Lana Del Rey, Chance the Rapper, Haim, lots of kind of younger acts that were on the kind of club and theater level, but those are the ones who make up kind of the real meat of the festival lineups.
Thanks, John. Wall Street Journal reporter John Jurgensen in New York. For Gina Cervetti, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to the Wall Street Journal this weekend. America was built by innovators and dreamers like you. To celebrate, LegalZoom dedicated this month to innovation by making it easy for you to file trademark or copyright applications, incorporate your business, or form an LLC. Call or visit LegalZoom.com. They'll provide the personal attention you need and help take care of all the details. For a limited time, get a special price on trademark and copyright applications by using the referral code WSJ at checkout. LegalZoom provides legal help through independent attorneys and self-help, but they're not a law firm.